Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 19 in our series for 2021, and today's date is Friday, June the 11th. First, I'll be talking to Frank Restuccia, founder and global CEO at Finder, and I'll be talking to IFM Investors economist Alex Joyner about the outlook for the Australian economy. But now, let's talk to Frank Restuccia.
Frank, tell us about this GoBear acquisition.
I'd love to. So GoBear has had an enormous amount of effort being put into its growth, and in the order of $97 million USD actually over its history. And its mission is to help people in that Southeast Asian region to improve their finances and their well-being. And that mission actually aligns very, very closely with Finder's mission. So over the last 5 years, they've been building that service in seven key markets in that region. And so we've been watching the brand, and we've long admired its success. Unfortunately, though, through COVID, they were quite reliant on travel insurance as a vertical, and that obviously tailed away quite quickly. And unfortunately, they didn't quite get the growth that they needed to sustain, I guess, their current operating model. So when we heard about this, I thought that it was actually an opportunity for us to actually pick up the baton in the region and deliver on that mission that they were trying to achieve. And of course, Finder, throughout its history, has had a global mindset and ambition too. And we've actually got a number of people actually working in Southeast Asia. And actually our service has been live as well in the region for the last 3 years. So I saw it as a complementary business for us to acquire and to merge with and progress on that mission to help people make better decisions.
Now, what are their markets? What's Singapore, Hong Kong, Vietnam?
Exactly. Yeah, their main markets are Singapore, Hong Kong, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. And as I said, they're headquartered in Singapore, so that was their main market.
Okay, and it very much fits in with Finder's model, doesn't it?
It really does. When I saw it and I saw some of the material and some of the commentary, it was so similar. I felt a real strong alignment with the brand, and I knew that therefore the customers that were using GoBear would be very well aligned to what our new service will be in that region for them. So that was the real main attraction for me, that there was just such an amazing alignment on the mission.
Well, it's also expanding your market massively, isn't it? I mean, Southeast Asia is home to something like 440 million.
Exactly. And what's actually really interesting is that so many of those people are actually unbanked. So, of course, there's a lot of sophistication as well in those markets too, but so many of them are unbanked. And I see that as a great opportunity to educate them along their journey of trying to make great financial decisions. And also, there's this great opportunity as well. Everyone's holding a mobile device these days, and that's where we're going as well. We're really putting a lot of effort into our mobile application and the Finder app. We've launched in Australia. We're about to launch in the UK and then around to the US. And then following that, we'll be launching that app through Southeast Asia. So I see a great opportunity for those customers in that region to benefit from the Finder app and in their mobile device. So we're bringing that service straight into their mobile, and I see a great opportunity for us and for them, actually. And that's a massive motivation for this acquisition.
How many verticals does Finder actually have?
So we pride ourselves on being that one-stop shop for people. And so we have actually over 100 categories on offer, primarily in our Australian markets, but increasingly now so in the UK and US. But yeah, we really compare everything from, you know, your home loan, your savings products, your insurances, your utilities, some of your retail decisions, some of the travel based decisions that you make as well. So we want to get that full complete picture of you, and then all those verticals we go deep in as well, and we help you make those decisions across those categories.
Well, the categories would include things like credit cards and home loans.
Yes, big focus on the banking verticals. That's where we sort of launched our story, Leon. We started off in the banking in Australia, helping people make better decisions with their credit cards and home loans and personal loans. But now, of course, we delve into all sorts of different things. And cryptocurrency has been something that we put a lot of focus in over recent years. That's been very, very popular, and people are very, you know, happy with the fact that we're there to help educate them and also give them some options to go and purchase the different coins. Trading accounts is actually something that's quite strong as well for us now. We really feel like we've helped people save money over the years, but now we also want to help them grow their wealth and actually help them take some of those savings and invest for the future in things like shares and crypto and actual property assets as well. That comes into it as well.
So how long has Finder been going for?
So we actually launched in 2006 in a very nascent way, a very organic way. We really started to get going in 2009. That's when we really put the foot on the accelerator. So we've been going over a decade, and we're actually just about to come up on our 15th anniversary in July. So we're looking forward to celebrating that.
15 years is quite extraordinary. Yeah.
Well, we still feel like we're just starting, Leon. So we're building this brand and the service to live beyond our lifetimes. That's the motivation for me personally, is that I want my children and their children to be able to experience the service and to get that great utility and satisfaction of being able to get some advice, use some of the tools that we provide, and really make some amazing decisions that are going to transform and help them live their life. And so, yeah, 15 years may seem like a long time. To me, it's just the beginning. It may sound a bit odd to say this, Leon, but we're really gearing up for a 1,000-year-old company. And yeah, it's a very ambitious goal, of course, but that's why I wake up every day to help build and achieve that.
Well, I mean, how many countries do you operate in?
We operate in 80 markets at the moment. So a lot of our categories are globally nature. And that's how we describe them, where the product is quite analogous across the region. So an example are things like trading stocks or cryptocurrencies or retail. Those are some of the decisions that everyone makes all around the world. Of course, people still make decisions around credit cards and health insurance, etc., but those ones tend to be a bit more localized. So what we've really done is focus on those global niches to help expand our footprint around the world. So yeah, 80 countries now.
And so, but you have offices in 80 countries or?
No. So we have offices in 7 countries, Australia, US, UK, Poland, Philippines, Canada. And so that's our footprint. So where we have our crew, we also have distributed crew around the world. There's around 20 countries where we have people currently. But of course, we use some of those countries to then launch into those other markets.
So what's ahead for Finder over the next, over the next 15 years?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we still obviously keep our sights on the short term as much as we think about the long term. So over the next 12 months, we're really, really focused on just improving and developing our product for our customers. So primarily that's going to be built around the Finder app. So presently, as I said earlier, we've really launched in a big way here in Australia and looking to increase that and make that a better and better service for our customers. But following that around to the United Kingdom, Now we have a team over there that's going to obviously localize and support that product launch into that market and then across into the States. So those are the three key markets for us and that we're really, really focused on. Of course, there's plenty of other activity going on day to day, but yeah, our focus is on that. And we believe that with the advent of things like open banking, with the proliferation of new products and services coming to the market every single day, that there's a lot of work for us to do, but we are here to simplify that for customers. We're here to help them and ultimately deliver those savings and those opportunities to grow their wealth.
What is a big growth area?
Yeah, look, I think the things that people are increasingly wanting to learn more and more about are things like how do I in this low yield environment, you know, if you think about, you know, savings rates around the world are really, really low. And so people are looking for options. How do I take my savings? How do I take my income and how do I transform that into wealth? And they're the categories that are really growing really quickly for us. As I mentioned, crypto, trading accounts, those sorts of areas are a real big focus for us.
So crypto will be a big focus for you over the next few years.
Yeah, look, it's one of those things where it's changing the world of finance so rapidly that we'd be remiss not to really keep on top of it. In fact, we were one of the early adopters of helping people make those types of decisions. Way back in 2016, 17, we really went hard at that. We actually built a brand called Hivex, which was a over-the-counter brokerage that traded to help people trade large volumes of crypto. And what we learned from that experience was, yeah, how to deal with, you know, all the processes behind the scenes and KYCing people and AML and so forth, AUSTRAC, et cetera. We learned a lot through that experience. We subsequently actually, someone wanted to acquire that brokerage and we actually sold it. But what we did do is retain obviously a lot of the knowledge around the space. And now we're looking to bridge the gap, I think, for a lot of people, a lot of consumers out there that don't really fully understand cryptocurrencies, but they actually really want to put some of their wealth and some of their income towards purchasing Bitcoin or Ethereum, whatever it might be. And so we're trying to create that bridge between the really difficult aspects of getting into the space and the everyday consumer looking to try to participate. So that's where we're applying our skills and our experience to help people with that.
Well, I imagine that's going to grow because all the central banks around the world are looking at developing digital currencies, and that's going to be huge.
Yeah, look, I think actually a lot of the governments that we interact with have a very, very strong bias towards innovation. And I think that crypto is an evolving thing for regulators around the world to try to get their heads around. But my attitude to it is that it actually creates a new world of possibilities for participants, for consumers, to try to do things differently, to use technologies like blockchain to make things more accurate and to make things more transparent and to sort of break down some of those walls and those legacies that exist in the banking world in particular. Yeah, I think it's a tremendous, we're really still at the cusp of major, major change. And we're just starting to see, I think, that mainstream acceptance of crypto. And yeah, I guess that's why we're so passionate about supporting consumers to better understand it and to participate in that whole new evolution.
Well, Frank, more strength to Finder's Arm. And thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Leon.
And now let's talk to IFM Investors economist, Alex Joiner. Well, Alex, the economy grew 1.8% according to the latest GDP. It seems to have recovered quite well, but there are some reservations about it. What are your views?
Indeed, there are reservations. I think, you know, we can be swept up in some of the good numbers first because it is a good narrative that we have. We have recovered as an economy much better than most other economies. There's a few notable exceptions, China being one of those. But the Australian economy is 0.8% larger than it was in real GDP terms in Q4 2019. So we have, in that sense, recovered from the COVID recession. The median outturn for global economies, say the top sort of 40 or 50 global economies, is still minus 1.9% smaller than they were in 2019. So haven't fully recovered in terms of GDP levels. So Australia has been effective in managing the public health crisis. It has had appropriate policies from the Reserve Bank and the government on the fiscal side. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at this outcome. You know, we have pretty much thrown 17% of GDP at the economy for it to recover. So it has come with a bit of a cost. And we have very, very low interest rates that are arguably creating some imbalances in the rest of the economy. How we exit those settings will be the big challenge, I think, to growth. And I think the GDP numbers sort of allude to some of these things because, you know, we do have growth that is fueled by cash balances, basically on the household side of the national accounts. So they're being sort of run down in an environment of still weak wages growth and still weak income growth. So we're sort of reliant on stimulus in that sense. We have dwelling investment that has been very strong, but again, reliant on, you know, government initiatives, the Home Builder program being notable among those. It was interesting, alterations and additions rather than new houses drove dwelling investment growth. So people using that Home Builder scheme. And then business investment. This is the big one for me, because there was a lot made of a pretty strong outturn in business investment in the quarter. It was a stronger number than we've seen for a long time. But then you look at where business investment is heading into this crisis and where it ended up during the crisis at the lowest proportion of GDP in a non-mining sense, or in almost the history of that series, you sort of think, well, it should rebound. We should be seeing a rebound. You know, the government is incentivizing businesses to invest through instant asset write-offs and initiatives like that. So we should be seeing these sorts of things. It's just how can we sustain this going forward? We're going to get some big base effects. We're going to see some big year-on-year numbers in terms of growth in the next two or three quarters. But how do we sustain it into, say, 2022 and beyond that? And that's where I get a little bit more concerned, because, you know, we haven't done anything to make the economy better in terms of productivity, you know, business investment, entrepreneurship in the economy, you know, incentivizing people to do more. We've only allowed the economy to recover. And like I said, that's a good thing, but we really need to do more on policy if we're going to sustain levels of growth that we want to see.
Now, one of the things you've always pointed out is that our economy has actually grown sometimes like 1.5% because of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But immigration was completely flat, totally flat. And so where does that leave us with growth?
Well, that was exactly right. It was one of the weakest quarterly population growth numbers. And that's obviously not surprising. You know, the borders are closed. So that makes perfect sense. And the economy still grew without that population growth. But then again, that speaks to the medium term challenges around what we've been reliant on previously. In terms of our growth rates, like you said, 1.5% growth was pretty much standard in the Australian economy in the years, 5 years leading up to the COVID recession. And we became reliant on it. Obviously, the per capita numbers were much, much weaker. We did have a per capita GDP recession through that period. And the big question for me is, are we going to go back to that 1.5% paradigm? Now, you know, there was a sneaky section in the budget that was away from the standard economic forecast chapters that had the government's expectations for net overseas migration. And they are pretty much going back to the levels that we saw prior to the COVID recession in the years after. So this is sort of in the 2020, 24, 25 out years. So getting back to importing people and those people going back into the labour market. And so I worry that we're going back to our old growth model in the first instance, which is to rely on just a bigger economy and not a better economy, and that we do that through population growth. And I also get concerned around the labour market, because labour supply was one of the things that made it a very difficult task for the Reserve Bank to get the unemployment rate below 5%. Now, we're making very good progress on the labour market. The last month's data was a bit of a setback because we had a decline in employment due to seasonal factors and arguably the JobKeeper program ending. We're making a lot of progress because we don't have that labour supply coming on. You know, working age population growth is very, very weak. It's basically just people aging into becoming working age rather than importing people. So net overseas migration basically all goes into the labour market. That's how Australia's immigration program works. And what we will have is a situation where that recovers very, very strongly when we've probably got the unemployment rate at around 4.75%, maybe a little bit above, according to the government's forecast and the Reserve Bank's forecast. Now, we probably need it a little bit lower to start getting this wages growth that everyone wants and to have sustainable wages growth. So, you know, we're going to be in this situation where we're approaching the Reserve Bank's objectives on unemployment. And then we're going to open the floodgates again on labour supply. So that will be a big challenge, I think, over coming years on just how we sort of digest that, or if we have a conversation about it. We don't really have a conversation about population growth. It's a difficult one to have on occasion, but we are just assuming we go back to that old paradigm. And I get concerned that it will be the old paradigm on growth as well. And we will have an economy that is pretty much how it was in 2019, and that wasn't great. No one would suggest the Australian economy was flying before this recession.
Indeed, and I mean, you talk about wages, but in the US they had to get unemployment below 3% about 3% to affect wages. And
that's exactly right.
Similar here.
Yes. So this is the thing I question this. So central banks use the paradigm of the Phillips curve, and that if we can get the unemployment rate down far enough, then we should be able to force businesses, because they can't get labor supply, to put up wages and bid for labor. And that's pretty much the what every central bank tries to do, because that's what every central bank can do with interest rates. You can affect demand and you can make demand so strong that you draw people into the labor market and tighten it up, and wages come through that. But I think in the absence of productivity growth, that is a much more difficult challenge. And that's why you have to see central banks aim for these exceptionally low unemployment rates that are difficult to get and even more difficult to sustain, because productivity growth is absent. You know, you think about it, it is much easier for a business to give wage increases if their workers are producing more, because, you know, they can produce more, they sell more, you know, you make more profit, and you can recycle that into paying people more. If you simply force or try to force businesses through the absence of labor to put up wages, then businesses might look for alternatives. They might look for different types of labor. They might look for capital investment to replace that labor. There's all sorts of things that are coming out of this that I don't think have been resolved and won't be resolved from monetary policy. And we're sort of starting to see some of this because, you know, getting back to population growth and that being very, very weak, there are skill shortages in the Australian economy. And, you know, we talk about how there are large amounts of vacancies in jobs, but we still have an unemployment rate that is above where we want it. How do we reconcile that? Well, businesses aren't paying higher wages to attract that labor in, and there are skills mismatches. So the people that are unemployed aren't necessarily skilled enough or have the correct skills to go into those jobs that are vacant. So we have a situation where, you know, there are increasing calls for borders to be opened up sooner so we can address those skill shortages. But again, that gets back to the fact that businesses don't want to pay higher wages or pay for those skills to be attained by the workers that are sort of remain unemployed. So it's a difficult paradigm to solve from the Reserve Bank's perspective alone with lower interest rates. You know, I think the government really has to come to the party to continue this, you know, impetus that we have with business investment to get the productivity outcomes and make it a little bit more easy for businesses to pass on wage growth on a sustainable basis rather than just trying to force them through the lack of labour supply.
Well, the other interesting part about the figures was we had a large rise in the number of savings.
Yeah, so the savings ratio, as we measure it in the national accounts, remained pretty high. It was came in about 11.6%. It came down a little bit from 12.2%, but it's very, very high. That's a very, very high level of savings. And it has been the narrative from a lot of economists and the expectations of the Reserve Bank that people run down that savings. And that's really something that keeps the economy going over the next couple of quarters in the absence of wages growth and incomes growth. So people's accumulated savings, and this comes from transfer payments, obviously, from the JobKeeper program and alike, but also the fact that people can't spend overseas. So we have sort of this trapped money. So people not spending on their, say, overseas holiday and are spending that money or saving it in Australia. I guess that narrative hasn't really been seen to play out as yet. Often after recessions and after economic shocks, it takes a very, very long time for the savings ratio to go down. So do people to become comfortable in running down those savings? I think what we need to see is a lot more job security, so the unemployment rate get lower and people get sort of some security around their employment, so they're willing to run down their savings. That sort of is what played out after the global financial crisis, and I expect that to happen again. It's just whether it happens with a rush. You know, retail sales hasn't, you know, shot the lights out by any extent, and it will become more difficult to assess that. And households, at least in Victoria, will be a little bit more, I think, reluctant to run down their savings because of the uncertainty. You know, you look at the Victorian lockdowns now, it's gone for 2 weeks, and hopefully that will be the end of it. But a lot of small businesses are households, and you know, so they're saving on the household side because their business is under pressure. And, you know, lockdowns and this feeds into, you know, the vaccination rollout and these sorts of things. You know, we still have a lot of uncertainty around the economy. You know, we all want to talk about recovery, but there's uncertainty in the economy. And if that uncertainty doesn't lift, then the household savings ratio will remain elevated. And that means things like retail sales rely on wage growth, which is weak. So they'll go back to a sort of a normal level of growth after experiencing some pretty outsized growth that we've seen in the retail sector over the last 12 months. That will just go back to, again, 2019, where it was pretty underwhelming.
Well, Alex, that's all quite illuminating. And thank you very much for your time again.
Pleasure, Leanne. Anytime.
So what's happening in the news? Well, business investment rose to a record high in May, consolidating gains over the previous two quarters and suggesting a shift in some sectors from post-pandemic rebound to a period of investment and growth. Capital expenditure has recovered to pre-pandemic levels in all non-mining sectors, and most industries are now well above their long-run average, according to the latest NAB Business Survey. Overall, business confidence fell slightly, but is still elevated compared to pre-pandemic levels, while business conditions rose to a second consecutive record high for the monthly survey. Trading conditions rose 6 points to be 47 index points. Profitability was also up 6 points to be 40 index points, while employment increased 5 points to be 25 points, all resetting record highs set in April. But in Creditor Watch's latest business risks review, credit defaults increased by 9% in the 3 months to May against the 3 months to February this year, and external administrations rose by 24% over the last 3 months. Businesses urged the Morrison government to cut Australia's 30% company tax rate after the world's biggest developed economies agreed to a global minimum corporate rate of 15% as part of a crackdown on the tech giants. A deal struck at the Group of Seven finance ministers at the weekend will force large multinationals to pay tax in countries they sell their goods and services in, most notably tech giants such as Google and Facebook. However, tax experts cautioned the agreement was unlikely to deliver a windfall to Australia, raising just hundreds of millions of dollars extra for the federal budget annually. The G7 agreement will go to next month's G20 finance ministers meeting in Italy, which includes Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, as well as leaders from China, India, Russia and Brazil. It will then feed into the broader deliberations the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development is coordinating with 139 countries for a global tax regime. Business groups, the Business Council of Australia and the Australian industry groups, seized on the G7 deal to call on the Morrison government to cut company taxes here. New research has found about 4 million Australians are likely to purchase digital currencies in the next 12 months, including more than a third of millennials. A nationally representative survey of 1,027 Australians by global researcher YouGov, commissioned by cryptocurrency exchange Kraken, found 21% are ready to purchase digital tokens. The percentage increases to 34% of millennials and 32% of Gen Z. Men, 27%, were found to be more likely than women, 14%, to purchase crypto in the next 12 months, while 40% of investors who had sold off their crypto assets indicated they were likely to buy back into the market. The research found 1 in 5 Australians have owned cryptocurrency at some point, with 14% currently holding an exposure in their portfolio. Of those, almost 85% indicated they intended to increase their exposure over the next year. On average, Australian crypto owners have 12.5% of their total assets invested in cryptocurrencies, with a vast majority keeping their exposure below a quarter of their portfolio. 1 in 10 investors held more than 25% of their assets in digital currencies. Wealthier Australians were found to be more likely to own cryptocurrencies, with 47% of respondents with household income in excess of $100,000 maintaining exposure compared to 24% of those with household income of $99,000 or below. However, almost 60% of crypto owners said they're likely to sell off some of their exposure in the next 12 months, with 35% very likely to sell some of their crypto assets. And Australia's first sulphate of potash mine will start production this week, and five local mines could be producing the specialty fertiliser inside 4 years. A new export industry will be born on Monday when the company's Salt Lake Potash declares first production and claims pioneer status ahead of the flock of rivals building sulphate of potash, or SOP mines, on Australia's ephemeral lakes. If all of them deliver to schedule, Australia will go from zero to five SOP mines in the next 4 years. They hope to snatch a piece of a small but growing industry that is now worth just over US$4 billion, that's 5.2 billion Aussie, a year globally, and is distinct from the US $20 billion plus muriate of potash, or MOP, that BHP is likely to enter this year when it is expected to build a new US $5.7 billion Canadian mine. Though SOP is a small end of the potash industry, it is also the premium end, with farmers typically paying 50% to 100% more for SOP, which is ideal for fertilising crops such as berries, nuts and citrus. And National Australia Bank, Crown Perth and Sky City are all facing the possibility of multi-million dollar penalties for potential breaches of anti-money laundering laws. Crown Perth is now facing a money laundering investigation by AUSTRAC. Sky City Adelaide is also being investigated for potential breaches by the financial crimes regulator. And NAB has been referred to AUSTRAC's enforcement team due to potential serious and ongoing non-compliance anti-money laundering laws. In separate statements to the ASX, NAB, Crown and Sky City told investors that they had been referred to AUSTRAC's enforcement team following the identification of potential serious non-compliance with anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws. AUSTRAC is a federal financial regulator tasked with preventing organised criminals and terrorists. Crown's casino in Melbourne was already under scrutiny for practices that may have facilitated money laundering. Sky City's Adelaide casino is under scrutiny for potential failures in the casino's treatment of high-risk and politically exposed customers in two periods, July 2015 to June 2016 and July 2018 to June 2019. The casino operator said it was in discussions with AUSTRAC and no decision had yet been taken by the regulator about whether and what enforcement action might be taken. NAB said it has publicly disclosed its ongoing discussions with AUSTRAC regarding potential non-compliance since 2017. It added that since June 2017, NAB had spent around $800 million in a multi-year program to improve its fraud and financial crime controls and employed more than 1,200 staff in that area. The bank noted that AUSTRAC had a wide range of enforcement options available to it, including civil penalties and fines, enforceable undertakings where the bank promises to do or not to do certain things, infringement notices and remedial actions. And Crown Resorts has avoided paying the Victorian government almost $200 million over the past 7 years by classifying marketing costs such as free parking as winnings paid out from poker machines when calculating its gambling tax bill. Victoria's Royal Commission to Crown heard that the casino had been deducting the cost of free accommodation, meals and loyalty scheme points from the money it takes through the 2,628 poker machines at its Melbourne casino since at least 2014. Crown's Executive General Manager of Gaming Machines, Mark Mackay, said that in February this year, Crown Melbourne CEO Xavier Walsh asked him to calculate how much it had saved Crown between 2014 and 2019. Compiled in a spreadsheet entitled Potential Gaming Tax Underpayments, the total came out to $167 million. However, Mr. Walsh said the total could be closer to $200 million if the past 2 years were included. Mr. Walsh said Crown believed it was entitled to make the deduction, but he agreed that the spreadsheet exercise had been carried out because of concerns about the ambiguity in the state's gaming tax legislation. Counsel assisting the inquiry, Jeff Kosminski, said that Crown Melbourne is supposed to pay Victoria gambling tax based on gross gambling revenue, which is the total sum of money received through gambling, minus whatever it pays out as winnings. And the ABC will pay $100,000 to cover Industry Minister Christian Porter's legal and share of mediation costs as part of a settlement after he withdrew a defamation action against a broadcaster. Appearing before a Senate Estimates Committee, ABC Managing Director David Anderson also revealed Mr. Porter made two earlier offers to settle the case, but the ABC rejected them. Mr. Anderson said the ABC's cost for defending the case had cost taxpayers $680,000. But if the broadcaster did not settle and the case had gone to trial, the exposure to taxpayers could have been as high as $1.5 million. And Qantas has written to four criminal intelligence agencies seeking further details of a disturbing report which alleges organised crime figures have infiltrated the nation's biggest airline. It said no law enforcement agencies have been in contact over the report, but moved to reassure stakeholders that regularly conducted criminal checks on staff and supported intelligence checks from regulators and investigators. The report, known as Project Brunello, and revealed by an investigation from 60 Minutes, the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age on Sunday, alleges near 150 Qantas staff have links to criminality and have used their positions to import drugs, among other illegal activities. Qantas's freight and baggage handling arms were identified as the divisions at the highest risk of infiltration. And soaring demand for commodities and record iron ore prices have driven a surge in the value of Australian exports to China in the first 5 months of the year, despite tariffs and bans on billions of dollars worth of goods. More broadly, data released on Monday also showed that China's appetite for raw materials and imports in May growing at the fastest pace in 10 years. However, supply chain bottlenecks and small COVID-19 outbreaks around China's southern ports slowed the pace of exports more than expected. Customs data showed the value of total trade between Australia and China rose 32.6% year-on-year between January and May to US $62.4 billion at $80.7 billion Aussie. Imports increased 33.3% during that period, and exports were up 30.6%. High iron ore prices, which hit a record of more than US $230 a tonne last month, drove the increase in trade values at a time when diplomatic relations hit rock bottom and China warned it was seeking alternative markets to fuel its steelmaking industry. China's total iron ore imports, measured by volume, increased 6% to 444.89 million tonnes in the first 5 months of the year. By value, they rocketed 85.7% to US $40.4 billion. China is largely dependent on Australia and Brazil for its iron ore. And the Australian higher education sector will have lost $3.8 billion in revenue by the end of 2021, with billions more expected to evaporate in the coming years as a pipeline of international students slows to a trickle. The sector has taken a bucketing from closed borders, compounded by a lack of government intervention and strategic planning in getting international students back into the country. There is now, however, a glimmer of hope as some states, New South Wales, South Australia and to a lesser extent Victoria, advance plans to bring small numbers into student-specific quarantine facilities. Experts say the aftershock of the revenue shortfalls will be mostly felt in the research capacity of the universities. And petrol and diesel supplier Ampol is a secret ingredient in a green hydrogen energy startup that will target the $1.5 billion a year remote diesel power generation market, offering the potential for reliable energy that is clean and affordable. Ampol has taken a 20% stake in CSIRO-backed Endure and is a commercial partner for the venture, which is developing renewables-based hydrogen power units that could be used at mines, farms and residential communities that are not connected to the grid. Endure is a child of the venture science model of business creation pioneered by CSIRO's technology and investment fund Main Sequence Ventures, which has already given rise to plant-based meat champion Vitude, backed by rich lister Jack Cowan space startup Quasar. The model starts with identifying a major challenge that offers a commercial opportunity to be solved, then assembling the science capability to tackle it from CSIRO, and introducing a pathway to market through a leading industry player which is involved from the start. Venture investment is injected by Main Sequence. And at least seven Australian firms are among dozens of companies that were infected with the same ransomware that last week crippled meat processor JBS. JBS was forced to shut down operations in Australia and locally stand down 11,000 employees. JBS also suspended operations in the US after the attack, a tribute to Reval software. Hackers have posted a list of victims of the Reval software on the dark web, an area of the internet that is hidden from conventional search engines. Australian companies on the list include a law firm, accounting firm, consultancy, an organisation for mental health carers, a chemical packing firm, a liquor group cooperative, an online clothing retailer, and a strategy-focused consulting company. The hackers encrypt company software, files and backups to paralyse a firm's operations. The cyber criminals also issued an ultimatum to these companies, pay up or face having your infernal files published online. If companies refuse to pay, the hackers increase the pressure on firms by leaking bits of their data day by day. They threaten to make the files downloadable and in some cases hold auctions to make the data available to those firms' rivals. The dark web listings seem not to include companies that gave in to cyber criminals and paid up. Publishing a company's internal records, including details of employees and customers, puts those people at risk. In some cases, cyber criminals have posted photos of employee passes, credit card images, and passport identification pages. And a renewable solar hydro energy plant will be built on the site of the Liddell coal-fired power station in the Upper Hunter region of New South Wales. Operator AGL has engaged energy firm RayGen to develop the new plant, which will use a mine of mirrors to direct sunlight onto a tower of solar panels, which in turn store energy in water reservoirs in conjunction with batteries. AGL RayGen also revealed plans to build a $27 million plant in northwestern Victoria using the same technology. The planned 2023 closure of the Liddell Power Station has led the federal government to commit to building a controversial taxpayer-funded gas-fired power station in nearby Kurri in the Hunter region. Analytic investigators are reviewing the level of control that Macquarie Group held over its 76% owned subsidiary Nuix in the lead-up to the $1.7 billion IPO of the Glamour Tech stock last December. The corporate regulator has issued Section 19 notice to Nuix and Macquarie as ASIC considers whether Nuix overstated forecasts ahead of its listing in an investigation that has been running for weeks. Nuix investors have seen $2.9 billion wiped from shareholders from the peak in January after the data analytics company issued two earnings downgrades. And that's it for this week. And next week, I'll be talking to Neil Littlewood, the CEO of national shipping container company Royal Wolf, which has created a bespoke shipping container solution for Griffith University product, investigating the production and use of maggots for medicinal purposes. And I'll be talking to economist Nicholas Gruyan. In the meantime, you can catch me on Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you want, leave a comment. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week, and looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.